Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Court is pleased to welcome Priscilla Owen of the Houston Bar with us today. She will be assuming a place on this court on January 1. The court has three matters for oral submission today. In the order of their presentation, they will be as follows. Brownsville Valley Regional Medical Center, Incorporated, doing business as Valley Regional Medical Center versus Ernesto Gamage from Cameron County. Virginia Indonesia Company versus Harris County Appraisal District from Harris County Appraisal Review Board from Harris County. And Philip Smith Sr., Philip Smith Sr. Family, Mike Jackson, Harris County, Texas, and Texas Water Commission versus Houston Chemical Services Incorporated from Travis County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. The arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Brownsville Valley Medical Center versus Gamage.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Nye will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Let me say at the outset we have received a motion for leave to supplement the record from respondent, and the court will carry that along with the case. We've not had time to study it and make a ruling on it. If that affects your argument, argue it both ways.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Nye, and I represent the petitioner defendant, Brownsville Valley Regional Medical Center. This appeal involves a dispute over ad litem fees. Specifically, this court is asked to address and decide whether my client has the obligation to pay, as part of court costs, $37,000 to the ad litem for future services to be performed over the next 22 years. I think the clear and only answer to this question is no, for three reasons which I'll discuss this morning. Number one, the litigation ended in this suit when the judgment was signed. Number two, there's no ongoing conflict of interest between the parent and the minor child. And three, there's some policy considerations which must be addressed as to why trial judges should not be allowed to award future ad litem fees. Before I discuss each of these areas, let me first address the facts briefly. The underlying case involves a personal injury suit brought by Mr. and Mrs. Diaz's next friend for their child, a minor child, Diana Diaz. The injuries resulted from occurred at birth. There was a dispute over causation, but there were no dispute over damages. She was severely and permanently disabled, and she suffered brain damage. The case was settled for $1.2 million, out of which the minor ultimately received and was invested into her trust a little over $400,000. After the case was settled, the plaintiff's attorney filed a motion to appoint an attorney ad litem. In that motion, he said there's a conflict. There's a conflict between the claims of the parent, and there's a conflict between the claims of the minor children. The ad litem...
After the case had been settled?
After the case had been settled. The ad litem in this case was appointed on a Thursday. The settlement hearing occurred on the following Tuesday, at which time he met with the parents for the first time. Testimony was presented, and a judgment was signed. In order to simplify the issues, we do not dispute that 15 to 20 hours was spent by the ad litem prior to and up until the time of the judgment. Also, we do not contest that $100...
Although that does seem a little high. Basically, 15 to 20 seems a little much given what you just described.
I agree. But the interest of my client is to have a reversal and rendition of judgment. In order to eliminate the dispute, we'll concede to the 20 hours. But I agree that there were really only four things done, and it did seem a little bit high. We also do not dispute that $100 is a reasonable hourly rate. There was one reference in the testimony that he normally charges $150 an hour. If you take the maximum of 20 hours times $150 an hour, my client is asking this court to reverse and render judgment that the ad litem should receive no more than $3,000. under the undisputed evidence in this case.
You're changing your position from that. You're taking on the brief. On the brief, you took the position that that litem ought to get $2,000.
That's true. I want to avoid any possibility of a disputed fact. In order to avoid that possibility, even if this court takes the maximum range of $150 an hour, that would be $3,000. If the court decides that $100 is a reasonable amount, which the Court of Appeals said was a reasonable minimal amount, then it would be $2,000. But under the undisputed evidence, it's either going to be $2,000 or $3,000.
Isn't an ad litem in this situation at risk for liability in approving a settlement should the minor at some point dispute the fairness of the settlement?
Yes, Justice Spector, the ad litem is at risk. There's a recent case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals which held that an ad litem can be sued. That's a risk that we all face in the practice of law. And built into our hourly fee as part of overhead is the cost of legal malpractice insurance if we choose to purchase it. And built into the fee of the $100 that he charges or the $150 that he charges per hour is the obligation or the opportunity, if he so chooses, to purchase malpractice insurance. There should not be a lump sum award of $3,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 because there's a risk of being sued in the future. There's a lot of areas of the law where that risk does exist. In this case, the ad litem testified that he had a moral and ethical obligation to the parent and to the child. The trial court agreed and awarded $40,000.
Mr. Knife, what do you, to resolve this case, is it necessary for us to I guess, define what it is an ad litem is supposed to do?
Absolutely.
What do you say should be the definition or the standard that an ad litem is supposed to meet or be?
Judge Enoch, it should be conflict of interest. This court said in two cases in 1992, in the McGuff case, in the Davenport case, one involved the appointment of an ad litem, the other case involved the termination of an ad litem, and in both situations, this court said conflict of interest is the only standard by which we appoint a guardian ad litem, and it's the only standard by which we terminate an ad litem. And that's really the issue before this court. When did the conflict of interest terminate? And we contend that it terminated when the judgment was signed, the litigation was over. He was appointed for the purpose of representing the minor in the above entitled and numbered cause. That cause ended when the judgment was signed. The only ongoing dispute is over ad litem fees. There's no ongoing dispute between the minor and the parents for the next 22 years.
Did the under the pleadings, the cause of action in this case, did the minors and the parents have a conflict of interest?
Yes, they did initially.
And what was that?
The conflict of interest was how to divide or apportion the $1.2 million settlement.
The conflict of interest was represented by claims being made both by the parents for themselves and for the children for their injuries, and that being made on behalf of them by their parents. And the conflict being that the parents not only were seeking damages for themselves, but ostensibly seeking damages for the children that might get involved in some sort of dispute as to how who gets what portion of the money.
Absolutely. So the parents might say that they're entitled to a higher portion of the $1.2 million, whereas it might be in the best interest of the minor child to receive a higher portion.
If the parents bring no claim on behalf of themselves, but only bring a claim on behalf of the children, is there any conflict in the case?
I don't think there's any conflict.
If there's an offer of settlement and the decision has to be made as to whether the settlement's too high or too low, is there any conflict in the case if the parents are not have no claim of for themselves in that circumstance?
There's no conflict. In that situation, the attorney is representing the minor child and determining what's in the best interest of that minor child. The parents are just suing as next friends in the Rule 44, and there's no conflict in the case. Because the litigation in this case has ended, there's no ongoing conflict of interest, and that's my second reason why the judgment of the trial court should be reversed. Under Rule 173, the Rules of Civil Procedure, it states in pertinent part that when the next friend appears to the court to have an interest adverse to such minor, the court shall appoint a guardian ad litem. As I referred to previously, this court on two occasions discussed in the appointment of a guardian ad litem when that is done. In McGuff v. Supreme Court of Appeals, this court stated in a per curiam opinion, the appointment of a guardian ad litem is appropriate only when there's a conflict of interest between the minor and the next friend or guardian. In that case, it was the only case in Texas where a guardian ad litem was appointed after judgment. But in that case, this court specifically referred to findings of the trial court, where the trial court found that there was a conflict of interest and an ad litem needed to be appointed after judgment. There's no evidence in this record whatsoever of any conflict of interest or any ongoing conflict of interest between the minor child and the parents. Also, in Davenport v. Garcia, this court held this majority opinion in a suit involving the termination of an ad litem. There, the ad litem argued, I shouldn't be terminated because I represent what's in the best interest of the child. The court said that's not the standard. The standard is that you should be terminated when the conflict of interest is resolved. The court stated, in an opinion written by Justice Doggett, under our current procedural rules, the sole circumstances in which a guardian ad litem can be appointed is when the minor is represented by a next friend or guardian who appears to the court to have an interest adverse to such minor. This rule, as written, seems to contemplate only a conflict of interest standard, and that is what the petitioner is advocating in this case. Justice Heck, in the concurring opinion in Davenport, pointed out and elaborated on this point. If the conflict of interest which occasioned the appointment of the guardian ad litem disappears, then it seems to me that the guardian ad litem must be removed. And that's what happened in this case. Once the conflict is resolved, once they apportion the money, then the ad litem must be removed. There's no need for the ad litem. Justice Heck went on to state, it makes little sense that a guardian ad litem cannot be appointed without a conflict of interest between the ward and his next friend or guardian, but may continue to serve after the conflict disappears. If the ad litem is allowed to continue to serve after the conflict disappears, it puts a burden on the parties and it leads to the possibility of abuse. And that puts me into my third area of concern, and that's the policy considerations. In this particular case, the ad litem testified at trial, it is a moral obligation I have as well as an ethical duty that I've assured the court and assured counsel for the plaintiff that I would pursue. It's ironic that that moral and ethical duty only lasts 22 years. Does that moral and ethical duty on the part of the ad litem last more than 22 years after the life of the trust? And if so, who's going to perform that duty and who's going to pay for it? Maybe more to the point, in this case, unfortunately, the minor child is not expected to live very long. Let's say, hypothetically, she dies after 2 years. In that case, does the ad litem have a moral and ethical obligation to refund the unused portion of the ad litem fees? I think that's a question that the ad litem should answer. It's a very real possibility.
I'm a little unclear what it is the claim for future services would entail. Are the proceeds this trust invested? Is the ad litem involved in the investment decisions, or is that made by some other fiduciary?
Yes, Justice Cornyn. In this particular case, when the judgment was signed, the ad litem approved the payment of the funds to the registry of the court. After that happened, a trustee was hired at a local bank, and all the money was placed in trust for the benefit of the minor child, giving the trustee of that bank the sole authority over that trust.
So what would the future services of the ad litem entail?
I think that's an excellent question. The court, in a subsequent order, on the 75th day after judgment was signed, said it ordered the ad litem to review the trust.
You mean after the plenary power had to expire?
After it, I think it was the 75th day. There's a dispute as to whether or not the trial court still has plenary power. But on that day, the trial judge says, well, you are to review the trust. give an update every 6 months.
Was there a hearing before that?
No hearing whatsoever. It was apparently totally on the court's own motion. And just on the 75th day, an order came down.
What did the order say?
The order said the ad litem is to monitor the trust. The ad litem has to report, has to file a report with the court every 90 days about the trust, and the court and the ad litem is in charge of monitoring the trust for the next 22 years. The problem with that order is that there's no basis, either legally or factually, as to why the ad litem should monitor the trust for the next 20 years, especially when a trust has been set up and a trustee of a bank has been appointed. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. No one has ever told us why there's a need for an ad litem to duplicate the efforts of the trustee. We had unobjected to expert testimony from an attorney who was an ad litem, who was also a trustee of a bank and head of the trust department, that said that the ad litem's duties in this case are totally unnecessary. It's just a duplication. And that's what's wrong with the trial court's order and its judgment in this case. And it creates a lot of problems in the future when the trial judges award future fees. There's no guarantee that these services will be performed. It's pure speculation that anyone's going to serve exactly 20 hours a year for the next 22 years.
You talk in terms of no showing that these services are necessary. Under what authority does a court appoint an ad litem to monitor a trust?
I think that would probably be under either the trust code or the property code, section 142 of the property code. This ad litem, if I can answer the question, this ad litem was appointed pursuant to Rule 173 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. He was appointed because of an apparent conflict of interest over the apportionment of the settlement proceeds. Once that conflict was resolved, his duties ended.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ernest Gomez, Jr. will present argument for the respondent.
Your Honor, good morning. First of all, Your Honor, the primary duty, primary goal, the primary function, public policy dictates one thing, not to disguise arguments to benefit one side, whether it be an insurance defense counsel or whether it be a plaintiff, not to disguise arguments as far as monetary gains, but what is the best interest of the child. Simple. Rule 44 says, next friend appointed, placed as a part of the lawsuit, court removes it and places the guardian ad litem. I didn't make up that word, guardian ad litem. That's what I am, or an attorney ad litem. I guard the ad litem. The minor moves on. 144 becomes a part, real party in the suit. Second, 177, if a conflict exists. Well, it's quite difficult to sit here and say, well, the settlement's over, gentlemen. We have a trustee, and the conflict stops. In April of 94, Woodrow Downs thought, as many people do here, and that is, settlement's over, conflict stops. But we've got a check that's forged by a stepmother, and the child then raises this lawsuit. I never got my money. The conflict, gentlemen, when there's money, Your Honors, does not stop. I'd love to say that it does. Look, you're not taking anything from me if I'm not awarded these attorney fees. I've been paid zero. My travel expenses to Corpus, my travel expenses here, the appeal, all right, here, 40, 45 hours for the appeal, for the appellate court, 40, 45 hours here, the travel expenses, that's fine. I still have a duty to this child. Now, we can sit here and argue, nothing's been done for the child. Untrue. Is it relevant and necessary to supplement what you have? I've given you and shown you. So I don't know if you've had time to look at this one certain area. I've expressed, and Oberson does not give the order or direction that attorney litem must document everything he does, must review and show someone what his work product is, I've shown where I saved this child at least $15,000 in bills. Now, I've even written the Attorney General, Dan Morales, here, and called him. I said, look, this child's being charged $5.50 for a gallon of water that costs less than 10 cents. All right? I've even called the Consumer Protection Division to try to lower some of these fees for the child. Oh, but we have a trustee. Right? And they argue so nicely. A trustee, once he's appointed, he takes care of everything. All they do is monitor portfolio and keep accurate accounts of those expenses and invest. I'm not an investor. I'm not a banker.
Mr. Gomez, the parents had a claim and the child had a claim.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you were appointed to review the claim from the child's perspective to determine if that was fair to the child, correct?
That was one of my functions at that time, Your Honor.
And you determined that that settlement was fair to the child, correct?
That is also correct. That is a function that I must provide under 173.
Then the case was over with. What conflict now exists that you say is the basis for the need for an attorney representing the child?
It is a good question. It is one of logic and reasoning that I will answer, Your Honor. Example, I've had the trustee call me and say, parents want money for this. This shouldn't come out of their portion. It should come out of her portion. The trustee, Dennis Frater, calls me on each and every bill, and I tell her and inform her, no, do not pay this bill. If she wants to sue the daughter, she may do so. Right? I will okay and approve and have each and every bill. If we think that this conflict
starts... Do you render a bill to the trustee for that service?
Your Honor?
Do you render a bill to the trustee for that service that you provide for the trustee?
No, sir. The court has made me an overseer of the trust. I have to review the trust, and I have, we make this allegation 22 hours per year. I have erred in judgment, but it could be more or less. Right now, the first year was something like 30, 35 hours for the first year. Second year, another 35, 40 hours. Second year, I can't stop just because I say all I needed was 20 hours. That's what I spent the first time to review a complex medical malpractice case.
So let's go back to the conflict. Isn't your responsibility because the person who brings the suit on behalf of the child has a conflict between their representing the child for the child's damages and representing themselves for damages, and your job is to assure that the child's share of what of the settlement is fair. Now that it's in a trust, is there any conflict between the trustee and the child? Is the trustee making any claim to the corpus of the trust, any claim to having an interest in the trust?
The trustee certainly is not, as an employee of the bank.
Then what is your role with respect to the trustee's function on this trust?
There is no duplication of work product. For example, for the following reasons. The administrator, the trustee will call me. Should I pay this bill? It is $40,700. And she, as the trustee, does what any trustee does. She receives the bill she pays. I write her back in June of this year saying, no, I will reduce this by 20%. All right, there you have the trustee, you cannot do this. All right? And I did so and reduced the bill from $47,000 to $32,000. Another bill from...
Mr. Garman?
Yes.
Some of the activities that you would... provide are not more properly part of a guardianship if that's required?
Your Honor, I believe in the probate code 110, it allows a guardian to continue on as a ward. That's exactly what I'm doing.
But you're not under the supervision of the probate court, in other words.
That's correct.
The situations that you're describing seem to me more properly placed in the probate court.
Well, then we need our legislators to change 173.
I think this is a difficulty we're having, Mr. Gomez, all of us, and that is, what authority is there for continuing performance of an attorney ad litem when there is no litigation? Ad litem means litigation. There is no litigation. The case is over. Isn't this a more appropriate role for a guardian of the estate of the child appointed by the court?
Your Honor, you have an interesting function. There is none is right. That if we separate ourselves from 173, the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, when the court realizes there's a conflict, it will appoint a guardian ad litem. Right? When they have adverse parties. If you really think that that adversity between those two parties changed, right? Then my
But isn't this a role, if the state needs protection from the parents, isn't this a more appropriate role for a court-appointed guardian of the estate of the child?
Your Honor, if you have a trustee or you have annuities, and a trust is very different from an annuity, you don't have a probate. The probate is unnecessary. That's a totally different area when you have parents that no longer exist and you have someone probating the child's estate or a guardian of the child's estate, Your Honor. When there is a deceased parent or deceased parents, then I concur in that fits in so perfectly. That is not the case here.
Well, if there's a trustee here and she needs legal advice, can't she just hire a lawyer?
That argument was made quite effectively in Woodrow and Downs, the attorney ad litem, in April of 94. And the court made it clear there, in fact, even cited this case, of the continuing fiduciary relationship with the attorney ad litem and the child. If the child has no attorney ad litem, Your Honor.
The court in that case said that the guardian should continue on as the guardian is in this case.
That's what it says. If the attorney is compensated, then so does his fiduciary relationship. If you look at that, Your Honor, I believe you'll find that. Court held.
So it says his employment should continue.
Well, he was let go on a summary judgment because the court terminated the services.
Suppose he becomes incapacitated and can't perform the services.
The attorney ad litem?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Or dies. That argument is well taken. That's one that, Your Honors, you're going to have to consider. So what did the attorney ad litem do? He's representing the child, say, look, I'm working more than 20 hours. Cut it off. Stop me somewhere. Just because we say that it stops and the need stops doesn't mean it stops. Judges.
Well, I'm not sure what the answer to my question is. What if the guardian becomes incapacitated or, as you say, dies?
Well, then, we go back to 173. Is it in the best interest of the child to stop the attorney ad litem's function? Then so be it.
Well, then we're saying the district judge maintains control over that child during the whole time? Isn't that the function of a probate judge?
Your Honor,
if the
argument's well taken.
If the attorney dies, then the only one that could appoint a successor would be the district judge that appointed the attorney in the first place.
Then we'd have to restructure legislatively our system. That is, every attorney ad litem.
The law already provides for a probate judge.
Every child, then, Judge, must then go to a county court to pursue and protect their interests. If that's your ruling, then so be it.
Mr. Gomez, Mr. Nye asked a question that the trial court made provisions for guardian ad litem for 22 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
And awarded a sum of $40,000. And he asked a question, what if the child dies at 2 years? Is there a refund of money?
You can decide that, Judge. At this point, there's nothing to refund because I received nothing, which is fine.
I understand that, but, you know, what is your answer to the question he posed? What should we,
Judge,
what should be done in that circumstance?
Here we come again. We make good, logical, reasonable arguments. Now, what is in the best interest of the child? I mean, that's what we're talking about. Is it in the best interest of the child when the attorney line dies, did you stop or appoint someone else to have him pay back? Do you pay the attorney line per hour? Or do you just charge the child from the trust? Or charge the child from her monies? Force me, I don't have the answer for that. But I don't know who does.
But if you prevailed, the $40,000 would go immediately into your bank account, wouldn't it?
I don't know of any other bank account that it would go to you.
All right. And then, would you be holding that in trust and then just take it out on an hourly basis? Or could you take $40,000 and spend it just like you would any other thing?
An idea the court may consider is deposit it with the registry of the court. That certainly is an idea. And bail
is
the
that
court.
What you're seeking in this lawsuit?
Yes. What I'm seeking is quite simple. Is if you cut the attorney ad litem off, Woodruff makes it clear, on the very most conservative jurisdiction, Dallas, Fifth Court of Appeals, said that this duty continues. And they weren't afraid to make that decision. And they said if you cut off the attorney ad litem, at that time, the child has no representation. Who does it go to if something goes wrong? Sure, you can appoint counsel, or the trustee can appoint counsel that has nothing to do with the case, doesn't know the parties, has never been involved with it, and they can start billing and charging who? The child? A child has never been responsible for their own bills in the state of Texas. Are we going to now then make her responsible? Because at that time, it's the old preventive doctrine. All right? Preventive medicine. The court does this, in my opinion, using its common knowledge, the 13th, as you said. It's savvy as a lawyer. And says, look, I'm preventing anything from happening. I'm appointing this guardian. Now, the other way to look at it is like a flu shot. If you take the flu shot and stop the flu, if you take it after the fact, it's not going to do you any good. What? How do you help the child if you take the attorney ad litem away, then the damage happens, and they steal $13,000 like they did in Little Cassie, and Dallas says, okay, now I'm going to the attorney. That already happened. That danger and damage already occurred to the child. What you're doing, what the court's doing is stopping it. And that is the most logical and reasonable thing to do.
What is
to protect the child.
What's the authority of the district court to make orders that continue on beyond the expiration of its jurisdiction?
Your Honor, it is clearly said that there is no case law on this. That's why we're here. There is no case law that says, district courts, you have the authority to do this. So you're going to decide whether they do or don't. And do so on the basis of, well, there's no conflict here. It stops once litigation stops. Well, then take a look at Woodruff. From Dallas. They say not only does it not stop, but hey, looky here, it happened. But,
Mr. Gomez,
yes, sir.
I'm looking for the Woodruff case that you're citing. It's not in your brief.
Judge,
it's a supplemental brief.
It's out in April of 1992. I'm not sure if my brief was already in by then.
Didn't you send it on in a letter?
Yes. I may have, Your Honor, but it is presently the controlling case that you ought to pick up and take it under your wings, because it overrules pretty much the government, as you said, McGough. It overrules Davenport. It overrules...
The Court of Appeals overrules...
Well, I mean, according to theory, Judge, the extension it does not overrule that. That was an improper term. It simply gives more advice, more insight, that, hey, I stopped Downs, but you know what? If we had an attorney like this wouldn't have happened. That check, a trustee, a parent says, give me $10,000. Trustee gives a parent.
Does a trustee have a responsibility to preserve the corpus of the child's estate and to determine the legitimacy of any demands that are made on the estate? Isn't this the responsibility of the trustee?
Your Honor, trustees,
investors, they're not just bean counters. They are supposed to preserve, act in the child's best interest as far as that estate is concerned. That includes the payment of expenses, payment of bills.
And they will do that, Judge. They will pay each and every bill without question.
Is that the responsibility of a trustee to pay bills without question?
I would think so. That's exactly what would have been done if the court would not have
wanted to. That doesn't sound like an exercise of a fiduciary responsibility of any.
Judge, if a hospital sends you $20,000, a $20,000 bill, you and I will argue. Please show me why and how come. If they send a trustee a bill, Your Honor, and they feel they're going to get sued on it, they will pay the bill. And that's a normal function of a trustee.
Well, a trustee could get sued for paying it when they shouldn't have paid it, too.
That's correct, Judge.
I think trustees have an obligation to examine the claim. And really, if you were serving as an advisor to the trustee, you were performing a service for the trustee, not for the child.
Well, who's going to do it, Judge? We have a trustee,
the trustee
that has no medical malpractice knowledge.
The trustee's going to have to hire his own attorney.
Well, Judge, if that's the way you think, then so be it. All I'm saying, this trustee has no idea how to provide for the needs of a vegetated child. That is the responsibility because of the error of judgment in the defendant. Now, if you say the trustee hires a lawyer each and every time, then so be it. Then what they do is then they charge the corpus of the trust. And we're charging the child. Is that in the best interest of the child? I think not. Here we have court costs as an attorney at Leiden. That's the way the bill is set up to be. Now, if you want to change that, if that's your function, then so be it. But it's clear, these are court costs. If we do it that way, then they're no longer court costs. And you've taken that 173 out of context. So do you want to bill the child? Maybe so. But I don't think that's the best interest of the child. All I can say is, you're not taking away a burden from me. All right? Because it is, I tell you, that trustee is on us all the time with these bills. That trustee, she'd have to hire a medical malpractice specialist, I guess. Because she has no idea when this child's operated other than when she gets her bills. And this child cannot walk, cannot speak, salivates, has to be fed through her stomach. She does not know and cannot know how to protect the interests of this child other than how to run a trust. Do you want to mix the two together, integrate it? Then so be it. Is that the best interest of the child? Or are we going to take arguments? Should the court do this? Should the court do that? Or should the court think of what the best interest of the child is? You want to cut my responsibilities off? Fine. And so does my liability stop. Hey, that's all right. I'm not complaining. I have a duty here as an advocate for all children. Right? And if you leave them alone, then so be it. Because that's what you're doing. If you leave them alone, then so be it. And the parents decide who they take and what lawyer and how to use their money. And so be it. I don't think we should do that to kids that can't hire their own lawyer. I think the court hires their lawyer.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I have three responses in rebuttal. The ad litem argues that he's here to represent the best interest of the ad litem, and he's going to do that for the next 22 years. However, his arguments don't match the evidence in this case. If the court will look at the Statement of Facts, Volume 2, page 22, the ad litem testified, "The bank will not make a move unless I, Gomez, feel it's in the best interest of the child." His first function that he did after the judgment was to sign a Section 142 trust agreement. He approved it as to form and context, and he gave exclusive control to the trustee. Well, if he's not going to let the bank make a move unless he sees it's in the best interest, why did he give exclusive control to the trustee? Take a look at paragraph 4 of the trust agreement at page 32 of the transcript. The trustee may make any distribution without the intervention of any guardian or other legal representative. His claims in this case don't match the evidence. He says he's going to look after the best interest of the child, but he gives total control to the trustee. And he wants to put all the blame on the trustee that the trustee doesn't know what to do. Well, the real problem is who hired the trustee? We have explanation from Carol Bailey that says we never need to consult with guardian ad litem. Never. It's unnecessary. That's the function of the trustee. And the trustee receives his or her fee out of the body of the trust. And that's where the payment shouldn't be made. The defendant shouldn't have to pay that for the next 22 years. That's not fair. Next, the ad litem argues that the case of Barrett versus Woodruff says he should win. I would ask this court to take a look at pages 25 and 26 of that opinion. where the court states, quote, case law limits the ad litem's powers to matters connected with the suit in which he was appointed, and the ad litem's powers end when the judgment is entered. That's exactly what we're arguing. The ad litem's duties end when the judgment is entered. There's a footnote, and they cite two cases. One is the McGuff case, which I've already talked about, and the unusual situation where an ad litem can be appointed after judgment is entered when the trial court found specific conflicts of interest between the grandparents and the minor child. No evidence in this case of that situation. The only other case that they cite is this case. But this case is wrong, both legally and factually, because there's no legal basis for continuing obligation of an ad litem, and there's no factual basis to support it. Finally, I'd ask this court to look at the task force report that it appointed. It came down with findings on March 1st, 1993. At page 7 of that task force report, they reported to this court, the current law is unclear as to the scope of the duties and responsibilities of many types of appointees and the procedural aspects of the appointment and functioning of appointees, which can result in confusion among the appointees, counsel, the judiciary, and main body. That's exactly what we have in this case. We have a tremendous amount of confusion between the trial judge and the guardian ad litem. The Court of Appeals disagrees, and it leads to abuse. That is why this defendant comes to this court, asking this court to give us some guidance and clarity to clarify this area, and so that it's very clear in future cases, so that these issues can be resolved. We respectfully request that this case, there's been a lot of time, a lot of effort spent into it. We don't want to have to go back down to the trial judge and make our pitch and possibly have a second appeal. We would respectfully request that this case be reversed and rendered because the undisputed evidence shows that the ad litem at best spent 20 hours at $150 an hour. That's what he's entitled to receive. And the other $37,000 should be reversed and rendered. If there are no other questions, we respectfully request that that result be reached in this case.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
Audience, please rise.